Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Sahavirnyam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Vatitamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Pratasmarami Kritisamspuratma Tattvam. Om Pratasmarami Kritisamspuratma Tattvam. Satchitsukam Paramahamsakatinturiyam. Satchitsukam Paramahamsakatinturiyam. Yat Swapna Jagra Shushuptam Avaiti Nityam. Yat Swapna Jagra Shushuptam Avaiti Nityam. Tad Brahma Nishkalamaham Nacha Bhuta Sangaha. Tad Brahma Nishkalamaham Nacha Bhuta Sangaha. Pratar Bhajami Manaso Vachasamagamyam. Pratar Bhajami Manaso Vachasamagamyam. Vacho Vibhanti Nikila Yadanukrahena. Vacho Vibhanti Nikila Yadanukrahena. Yaneti Neti Vachanair Nigama Avochan. Yaneti Neti Vachanair Nigama Avochan. Tandeva Deva Majamachuta Mahuragriyam. Tandeva Deva Majamachuta Mahuragriyam. We worked on this last week. This one line, yaneti neti, I'm going to spend some more time on. Then we'll go on to the next verse. Okay. Let me just translate this verse for you, just to remind you. Pratar bhajami. Pratar, in the morning. Bhajami, I worship. Manasaha vajasam agamyam. That which is agamyam. That which can't be reached by the mind or by words. Genitive, for the mind and for words, that's not available for reaching, for objectifying. Vachaha vibhanti nikilaha. But on the other hand, words, all words, vachaha nikilaha, all words, vibhanti, are manifest yad anugrahena, by whose grace. Okay, that which is a gamyan to the mind and to the mind and to words, and yet words are illumined, are manifest. All words are manifest by whose grace? Yam na iti na iti vachanaihi nigamaha avochan. That which yam, not this vachanaihi, by the words, not this, that which nigamaha, the shastra, Upanishads, the Vedanta Shastra, avochan, reveal, explain, reveal. Okay. Tam, that devadevam, that like ear of the ear, eye of the eye, that the consciousness of the conscious, that which illumines the sense organs in the mind, devadevam, which is ajam, birthless, free of birth, achutam, which never changes, which never transgresses its own nature, ahu, they say, the wise say, that which is devadevam, ajam, achutam, and agriyam, that which is the beginningless cause, first cause. So that's the verse. What we didn't spend any time to speak of is on the teaching methodology, right? This third line, nigamaha avochan, the Shastra reveals, which this Brahman, by the words na iti na iti. So I'm going to go a little bit more into that before we go on. Because the Atma, because yourself is already present as yourself, right? It's not the Atma isn't something to be experienced through some sort of meditation or some sort of practice, as though to experience something that's not already experienced. That would mean it's not me, right? It's like I would have to then reach that in order to experience it. That's the state of samsara. That's the state of the world. We have to gain knowledge of something that is not present because it's not me. But I'm present. And so gaining self-knowledge is not going to be about reaching something or gaining a vritti, a thought modification that's of something which is not already fully experienced as my own being. That's why we can't say fully experienced, because the word experience usually means I'm objectifying something. On the other hand, consciousness, the conscious being that I am, is not a non-experience, because it's self-evident. Consciousness is consciousness, so I am present. In fact, I am the bottom line. I am the one, I can say like this, I am the one for whom all experiences are. And if I say that, I am the one for whom all experiences are, then I can't have that one, who is me, who is present to all of these experiences, itself be a non-experience, like jada, inert, or non-existent. You know, some people will say, you know, if the Atma isn't, the Atma, the self, is not something that can be experienced, it can be known, it can't be known. We do say this in the Shastra, but we have to unfold it. So what if we don't unfold it, then what it means to people is, in fact, I just had this experience last week, it means that it's not there. The Atma can't be known. The self can't be known. It can't be objectified. It can't be experienced. Therefore, it's not there. It's not there, or it's not available to be known. Right? So therefore, if I am there, I can't know it. So what difference does it make? So these words are, the whole teaching methodology itself has to be understood, you know, how these words are used in order to unfold the nature of yourself. The words have to be handled. They have to be handled as a means of knowledge. They have to be handled as a pramana, you know, in such a way that, in fact, the self that you are, that is already present and self-shining, is revealed for what it is, rather than taken to be one with things that are being objectified. So, for instance, for a person within samsara, just within duality, without any self-knowledge, because this physical body enjoys consciousness, then I, the conscious being, am this physical body. Because my mind, which is thinking and feeling and knowing, because this mind enjoys consciousness, then I, my mind, is the conscious being. Right? I, my mind, am the conscious being, because there's no doubt that I am a conscious being. But because my mind enjoys consciousness, then I, the conscious being, am my mind. This is just samsara. This is what the mind has every right to feel this way, in fact. Because your mind is never without consciousness. As long as you have a thought modification there, there's consciousness there. So why shouldn't the mind say, I, the mind, am the conscious being? Right? And then it can go further than that. It can say, and, you know, I am alive, I exist, because this body is alive and this body exists. And as long as this body is alive, then as far as I know, my mind will be here. Right? So there's a conscious being, which is my mind, which is part and parcel of this physical body. And as long as the physical body is here and nothing happens, the mind and the sense organs will be here. And so I am this functioning conscious being composed of the body, mind, sense organs. This is the red hot iron ball syndrome. This is what this everybody's experience. And it's everybody's experience until we shine a mirror, in a sense, until we analyze that experience. And then we recognize that through neti-neti, not this, not this, not this, what this actually means, this type of teaching methodology, it's basically the drik-drisha, the seer-seeing differentiation. I'm not this means what? Something that I objectify, that I look at, that I watch change, that I watch come and go, while I remain illumining it? I'm not that. Right? So we start with the physical world, I'm not that, because I objectify it. Neti neti, not this, not this, not this, not this, because these things come and go. If you walk out of the room, I don't walk out of the room, so I'm not that. Everybody knows that. But that neti neti, not this, not this, not this, has to be applied to everything I can objectify, including the physical body, my sense organs, right? The thoughts in my mind, the moods and the emotions in my mind, neti neti, not this, not this, not this, not this, The ahankara, the I notion, not this. Moods, emotions, not this. Relationships, all objectifiable, right? They all come and go. And so what's happening with the neti neti, not this, not this, not this, I am removing from that self-evident me all of the things that, from the standpoint of the mind, you know, it has been confused with. Atma, your self-consciousness doesn't have any confusion because it illumines the mind. Right? It itself isn't thinking. The mind has the thought, the Atma, yourself, doesn't have vrittis, it doesn't have thought modifications, it doesn't have emotions. It illumines all of that. It can be differentiated. The Atma doesn't have to do that differentiation. It's just consciousness, you know? Say we use that example of, you know, the sun shining in the heavens, lighting up everything that is in its wake. Everything gets lit up by it. The sun isn't doing anything. It's not saying, let me light up this and let me light up that and let me light up this. It's just that everything that comes in its wake is lit up. It's self-evident, and everything benefits from that self-evident consciousness. We could talk like that. That self-evident light. But say it's lighting up inert things. Sun's lighting up as though inert things, non-reflecting surfaces, like the rug or like a house or like asphalt or like rocks. Those things are just being lit up. They don't have anything to say about it. But what about bodies of water? You know, like lakes or gutter water or ponds or oceans. Any of these kinds of things, reflecting surfaces, then those things have little sukshma shariras. They have these little subtle bodies. And they say, all of them say, you know, I am the sun. 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 And when the water is nice and the surface is clean and clear, they'll say, oh, I feel so much energy. I'm so much luminosity. I'm so bright. I have so much tejas. I feel so strong. And then when one surface has a bunch of mud in it, it'll say, I just feel so doughty and depressed, you know? I'm just not shining in the way that I'm used to shining. So there's all this variety going on. You know? Because from their standpoint, and the sun is there in them. They have the sun. They are the sun. That's kind of our situation, except the self isn't way up there. My being is not in consciousness. The being that I am doesn't have any distance. It's not, you know, my shining little sun of consciousness looming in a mind that is over here. There's no distance between me, you know, and the mind that's being illumined, or the sense organs that are being illumined, or the physical body that's being illumined. That subtle body is sattva. It reflects as though. Reflects, so I'm manifest in it. It reflects, as though reflects me. And so the mind has to be, it has to be pointed out to the mind that there's a subject-object differentiation, that in fact, you illumine the thoughts, you illumine the sense organs, you illumine the body. You can do a subject-object differentiation, and as you do that, as you make the differentiation, you can go from the objectifying the object to recognizing yourself, not as an object. You don't need to recognize yourself as an object because you're consciousness. You're differentiating the consciousness from the experiences that you're having. And when you make that differentiation, then you can see what you are, what your nature is, versus the things that you're objectifying that are coming and going. So this not this, not this, not this, it says, you know, by these words, not this, not this, not this, right? That which is explained. They're just starting at the very beginning of this unfoldment, because you need to, before you can understand, before the Shastra can really make you see that you're all of this, right? You have to differentiate yourself, you know, through the teaching. You have to see that your being is in fact not one with something that is part of all of this. So you say the conscious being, you, when you say me, this very intimate self that you are, say if there's a total, what we call mutual superimposition of your being with this body, then as me, as this body, I cannot be the whole. This body is not the whole. Right? This mind is not the whole. My sense organs aren't the whole. My relationships aren't the whole. Even if I take myself just the body, mind, sense organs all together, it is not the whole. It is part of the whole. We use the wave ocean example. You know, it's like the wave, as long as it's identified with the nama rupa, with the name form, it can't say, I am the ocean. Because it's not the ocean. The wave is not the ocean. The wave is part of the ocean. Each one of us, body, mind, sense organs, is not the whole. It's not the creation. It's part of the creation. So this person, if I were to say, you know, I am all of this, it happens to be true, but if somebody's just listening to that, you know, and you know what you're talking about, but say, this is the way you teach, your poor students are there, all innocent, all well-intentioned, and you come and plop yourself down, and you say, I am the whole, you are the whole. I am the whole, you are the whole. What will you say?
I don't believe you.
or you say, you have all kinds of things to say. Like one of them could be, somebody told me this when I was around 18, some young man, he seemed really stoned. I don't know if he was or not, but that's how he seemed. And he said, I am everything, I am the whole. And you know, intuitively, I knew that there was something true about that, but not about him saying it. And what I thought about him saying it, because it rings, there's some intuitive, you know, kind of feeling of the truth of that, even though you don't know what it is. But my feeling was, you know, he's either totally stoned or he's crazy. And I just retreated. I retreated. I didn't want to deal with it at all, you know. But say the person's a legitimate teacher, I mean, has that reputation of being a legitimate teacher, and they say, you know, there is really no problem. You are, in fact, the whole. You're all that is. Be happy. Go and be happy, for heaven's sake. You know, all is well. And that's it. That's it. There's no teaching methodology in that, right? That's why they start with this by saying, Yam neti neti vachanahi. By these words, not this, not this. This neti neti, they say neti neti here because it's the beginning of that teaching methodology. Until you differentiate the I means not the word I, but the me, the conscious being that is here, indwelling to start out with this physical body, mind, and sense organs. Until I can make that differentiation, there's no knowing of myself, there's only knowing of this kind of superimposed conglomerate, because I'm actually identifying myself with something that comes and goes, experiences that come and go. Like, look at the craziness of it, though everybody in the world suffers from it. Just think like this. Look at this. If I am objectifying a thought, I'm aware of a thought. Right? I have a subject-object relation. I'm aware of thought. Everybody say, yeah, I'm aware of the thought. Like if I ask you, are you aware of your thoughts? You'd say, yes, of course I'm aware of my thoughts. Okay, so you're aware of a thought. Now, the strange thing is that this thought, whatever it is, it comes into being and it goes. A moment ago you didn't have that thought. And the thought goes, you know, very quickly. So you have a moment of this thought, but the thought comes and goes. Now, how can you be that thought? If it comes into your being and goes out of your being, comes into consciousness, goes out of consciousness, and you, the conscious being, remain, how is it on earth is it possible for you to be that? It's not. It's an absolute impossibility just in your immediate experience. You can say that when the thought is there, you know, I am conscious of it, the thought enjoys consciousness. But when the thought goes and the consciousness remains, and you want to know yourself, you're not going to be analyzing what is left. You have to be recognize what remains still there. Then you can talk about the mind. You can say, my mind works like this, it thinks like this, it has these series of these type of emotions, I have these emotional problems, I have these kind of reactions. You can talk about all of those kind of things. But to identify yourself with these things that are coming and going is something that, for the most part, we just never thought of. The mind has never thought of, because from the mind's standpoint, right? It's from the mind's standpoint, all it realizes is that whatever thought I have, whatever thought, the mind talking, whatever thought is there, I, the conscious being, you know, am there. There is never a thought which does not, of which I am not totally present to, pervasive to. And so why shouldn't it recognizes the constancy of every experience that is there, of every thought that is there. There's a constancy, and the constancy is me, right? And so here you have, here's me, the ongoing me, like a raga, me, and the thought's going, you know? And the me raga never wavers at all. So everything is me. Every single thing is me. You see what I mean? And so the teaching of Upanishad has to come along and say, let's look at this a little differently. You know, let's recognize the me, which is staying, versus the thoughts that are leaving, and just look at the nature of that self. Even in contemplation, even if you're not, haven't been exposed to a teaching methodology, you know, in contemplation, look at what you're doing. You're relaxing your body, you're shutting down your sense organs so that you don't need to perceive this world, you know. You're quietening your mind with pranayama or japa or in whatever way you're doing that so that you don't have the thought flow, so that these things are not part of your experience. And then you, it's the key word here, you just sit there. These experiences aren't there. You've quietened them all down. You've shut down your sense organs. You've relaxed your body so even the tension of the body is not there. And you can make the body so relaxed that you can't even feel the outline of the body. The body you're not aware of. Because actually the body requires sense perception, right? You require the sense of touch to even be aware of it. So you're not aware of that. You know, you're not seeing through your sense organs. Your mind has become quiet. And so what's left? In terms of your experience, you've shut down all these experiences. What's left? Who's left? Just me. See, that's the trick. That's the thing. I'm still there. And I know it. I don't necessarily think about it, but nobody says, oh my gosh, I'm not here. That thought doesn't come. It's not that I'm not here. It's just, oh, this is so peaceful. You know, I'm here. I'm here without any extraneous matter to cause problems or to hurt me. I'm just simply here, you know. And then with Vedanta, the whole teaching, even in Nididhyasana, in contemplation, the teaching will point out to you, differentiate, acknowledge that one who is here. And recognize then, in so many different teaching methodologies, that this me that is here, in fact, is always here. It never changes at all. There's no variance at all. No matter what the thought is, if it's sukha or dukkha, you have a happy thought or a sad thought or an agitated thought, you are still the one, you're the sun illumining those. And you are self-evident. You never say, I am miserable. You can say, I am miserable. Okay? Right? So there's the I am here, and so is the miserable condition, right? I am happy. I am agitated. I am always here. It's not that, you know, it's like the sun illumining a muddy water bucket. You know, the sun hasn't become muddy. The sun hasn't changed its swarup, its nature. It still is. I am, conscious being me, I am totally present to this misery. In fact, I am so present, I am totally present to this misery. The problem is that the misery is what's grabbing all of attention. There's no differentiation between me and the misery. You know, it's true also when there's ananda. Say you have a happy vritti, happy emotion. You know, you're so happy. The mind is so happy. Then you say, I am so happy. No differentiation. Again, no differentiation. It's just the happy state is much more palatable, much more resonant with me. It's like the sun shining in the clear water bucket, right? So the clear water bucket feels so happy because that reflection is clear to my being. There's no, it resonates. So I'm happy with clear water buckets. I'm happy with quiet. I'm happy with quiet minds. No problem. But if the mind is muddy, if we call it misery, then that identity is problematic. The identity with the happy vritti is problematic too. It's problematic because it's a vritti. It's a thought modification, and therefore it's temporary. And that immediately brings sorrow. You have this very happy state of mind. You know, and you just love it. You enjoy it so much. And then the next thought comes, yeah, but it's going to go. Somebody's going to take it away from me. It won't last forever. Mm. It's naturally, because you're not stupid. You know, that's just the natural nature of the creation. So, in fact, it's very it's vital for this viveka, for this differentiation to be there. And for happy vrittis, sad vrittis, for anything that can be objectified, you have to have differentiated yourself so that you recognize the two things that are taking place in one space. There's the sat-chit, there's me, the sat-chit, and the changing nama-rupas and the changing names and forms. If that differentiation isn't there, then I am the changing names and forms and moods and emotions. Not that I am, no differentiation, and it's the mind that has the problem, not me. You know, I just remain the same. I'm not commenting on this. I just simply am. And that am is so, that amness is so whole and so full and complete. But it's overshadowed because the mind is so focused on whatever its conditions are. So instead of the mind focusing on itself, vritti upon vritti upon vritti upon vritti upon vritti, now what happens has to happen is the mind has to focus in this way, in a sense, instead of this way, vritti to vritti to vritti to vritti. It has to recognize the conscious being that is present, changelessly present, to all the vrittis, without itself being touched in any way. That recognition has to happen. And once that recognition, then I know myself. Not because I've had an experience of some self out there, some elated, some big capital S self, as though there is such a thing. There is no big capital S self. I'm the big capital S self. That thing is that I recognize me as that self, which is not an object, not objectifiable in the world, but is the constant base of all experience, not touched by any of it. Once I recognize this, then the Upanishad can do its job. If this isn't recognized, if I can't recognize myself, then I can't recognize that I am in fact the self of all beings, that I'm the water. I'm the water of the wave, which is the water of the ocean. You know? Once I've differentiated, then there's nothing between the conscious being which I am and the conscious being that you are. Because the conscious being that I am is not objectifiable, and the conscious being that you are is not objectifiable. It's not an object in the world. And so then the I that I am, this me, which doesn't have, it's not given a name and form. Name and form means it has to be an object in the world. I just am. And then I can go to analogies. There's so many different prakriyas in, you know, teaching methodologies in Vedanta. Now I can use the dream analogy. You know, there's so many. I can go to the whole satya, mitya, everything becomes available to me now. Because I recognize myself and the self that I am is not objectifiable. I've gotten rid of all of the objects. You know, in the tenth man story, when the old sadhu makes the boy count all of the nine guys, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and after he's counted all of them, then the old man says, 10, you are the 10th. You are the 10th man. You know what that counting is? Neti neti. Not this, not this, not this, not this, not this, not this, not this. You know? Everything that can be objectified has been negated. And then I'm left, I'm still left. The one who can't be objectified is still left. And then the Shastra goes, you are. You know, you are Brahman. Right? The Atma, that self, the Atma, the very self that you had taken to be this body, mind, sense organs, that self, in fact, is the self of the whole. There's so many different methodologies, but he starts with this neti neti, because you have to recognize the very freedom of yourself. You know, and if I can't be objectified and body, mind, sense organs are objectified, your body, mind, sense organs are objectified, your body, mind, sense organs are objectified, what makes me different from you then? My consciousness, the conscious being, then. What makes me other than you? You can say space is objectified. Body's objectified, sense organs objectified, mind objectified, emotions objectified, you know, the I thought objectified, space itself objectified, time objectified. But I'm the one left standing, so to speak. And then that's true for all of us. It's just like the dream, really. If you have a dream, you know, the dream for myself is the Ishwara of the dream. Everything is fine for me. The whole dream universe comes, you know, comes from me, it's sustained by me. I'm the self of the whole thing. It's obvious to me. If I ask you to have like the meadow imagination, the whole, imagine a meadow with yourself in it and beings in it and animals in it and, you know, trees and grass. You imagine the meadow. So that now the meadow has come. You are the self of the meadow. The entire meadow enjoys your consciousness, your being. And you're identified with the whole thing, you know. Not at all threatened by it, as though you're going to change. Right? If you have a meadow imagination, all kinds of things can go in the meadow. You don't go, oh my gosh, the meadow's hurting me. It's just the meadow. It's Maya. It's your Maya. The Maya has come. There's the meadow. You're fine. You're the lord of the meadow. And then you can withdraw the meadow, right? Without anything happening to you. Exactly as you are, the meadow comes, you're still exactly as you are, the meadow is sustained, the meadow resolves, you're still exactly as you are, nothing has happened to you. You are the Lord, you are the Ishwara of the meadow. But say you took a form in the meadow. Say you have a bunch of friends in the meadow. You're all walking around playing in the meadow. From the standpoint of the ones in the meadow, even though you are the self of the whole meadow and of every individual in the meadow, and each one individual in the meadow that has a subtle body has got a sukshma sharira, you know, like the mirror reflecting the sun, each one of those little characters is saying, you know, I am a conscious being, 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 and, you know, I'm subject to death, and I'm subject to the problems of my mind, and I'm subject to this, and I'm subject to that, and this one has more, and this one has less, and it goes on, samsara, complete samsara. From your standpoint, all of this is taking place in one whole lila. You know, it's just one whole play. There's no problem for you because nothing's happening to you. And you don't, even for all of the beings in it, you know, there's no problem. It's not real from the standpoint of yourself. Nothing's happening to any of them because all of them are only you. But out of Bhagavan's compassion, Bhagavan's extreme, infinite compassion, one of those little beings in the meadow is a mumukshu. And the mumukshu in the meadow says, who am I and what am I doing here? And what's the truth of this whole thing? There must be...
What am I doing here?
There must be something. Is there anything about me that is real, that's free from birth and death, that free from all of this papa, all of this samsara? I need a teacher. Bhagavan, please send me a teacher. You know, and that person, the mumukshu, that person gets a teacher. That's the nature. That's the law, right? And so then that person gets a teacher. The mumukshu gets a teacher, and the teacher comes. And now this teacher has a huge job, huge job, because the mumukshu, in the one who desires liberation, the mumukshu sitting in the meadow only has pramanas, means of knowledge that are looking around, you know, in the meadow, and this is the reality that's experienced by the means of knowledge that person has. My sense organs and all inference and presumption and all these things are just based upon, you know, what God-given, my God-given means of knowledge. And look at what the teacher has to do. But the teacher doesn't have to do, the teacher it's himself or herself was taught through Upanishad. There's a teaching methodology. So that teaching methodology still has to be wielded to help the student. But what the student has to see is incredible. The student, who is the little mumukshu within the meadow, has to see, I am the whole. I am the self from whom the meadow has come, who sustains the meadow, into the whom the meadow resolves. In fact, I am the very being of the meadow. I am the water of the ocean. That there is no meadow. There is nothing other than me here. Right? Like if I take the clay pot, there's no pot. There's a pot, of course, but there's only clay. This whole creation, this whole meadow, there's a meadow, of course, but really it's only me. I'm the Satchit of the meadow, and my being is infinite and free. That's what each mumukshu has to see. And it's the reality. So you can have intellectual knowledge, but intellectual knowledge is not freedom. Like say you were to say, well, isn't this interesting? The Shastra says, the Upanishads say, you know, that I am the whole. Okay? That's not good enough, right? It's not good enough. You have to see, I am the whole. It's not an indirect knowledge, right? It's not book learning. That's why teaching methodology, because you are here, this universe is here, this body, mind, senses, organs are here, the whole thing is here. There's a viveka that needs to be seen. There's something, discrimination that needs to take place so that you can say, see here, like it says in the first verse, it goes, Tad Brahma Nishkalam Aham. I. It's not somebody else. It's right. I am this Brahman. I am this. My being is infinite and it's free of any parts. That is me. I see it. Not I am Buddha Sangha. No. I am not all of these objects that I experience in the world. I am not that. I see it so clearly, you know? And so here he's going in this teaching methodology, going, you know, the Vedas themselves, they explain by the words, that one, that Brahman, by the words neti neti, not this, not this. And then what do they say? Then they point out that one, having negated everything, that one is the conscious being, the conscious being, that is the conscious being of the mind and the sense organs, deva-devam. That one is not objectifiable, it's ajam. It's unborn. It's never been born. My being has never been born. It's not an object within the creation to be subject to birth and death. It's achyutam. Again, not objectifiable. I am not subject to any type of change, any type of death. So the conscious me, this very personal me that I am, is in fact free from time. Right? And it is agriyam. It's the first cause. First cause means what? If the meadow comes from me, is sustained by me, and resolves into me, what is there as the cause? What's the upadana karana? It's me. I am the one that is the truth of the meadow. But what kind of upadana karana means the material cause? But what kind of material cause is vivarta? Vivarta upadana karana. Vivarta upadana karana means I am the material cause, but I don't go through any modification whatsoever to become the effect. Like I can say, you know, that's why we bring in this rope snake analogy. The rope is the vivarta upadana karana. It is the material cause of the snake, of the projected snake, right? But it's because why is it even the material cause of the snake? The rope appears as a snake. Well, because the rope has three bends.
Features.
Yeah, it's got three bends. The snake has three bends. You know, it's 2 inches in diameter. The snake is 2 inches in diameter. The rope has two little you know, prong sticking out of it, the snake has two fangs. You know, so say you were to pull the rope away, the snake's gone. And so there is nothing really there except the snake. That's what except the rope. That's what we call the maya. You know, the true. What is the truth of that maya snake? Not the maya. Right? You can't pick up the maya. Right? You can only pick up the rope. And so the rope is the satyam there. And so that's the first cause, because without that, right, there is no maya upadi. That is the very thing that is there. So that's what we have to understand here. Also, something that can be tricky about this is that, you know, when you imagine a meadow, say you imagine a big meadow with mountains surrounding and big trees and sky, that's pretty big. And so now, am I big? Is consciousness big? It's a big meadow, you know? I pervade the whole meadow. And so now I'm trying to recognize myself as big. This is a trick, you know? Yourself, the space, the size of the meadow belongs to the meadow. When you project the meadow, before you projected the meadow, was there size? Was there space? Was there dimension? The space, size, dimension belong to the projection. They belong to the meadow. Look at this whole infinite creation. What size? It's huge. It's huge. I mean, we can't even find ourselves on the map if you're trying to find yourself in reference to the whole creation. That's absolutely mammoth. Are you mammoth? You know? Are you infinite in size? Because the size belongs to the creation. Time, space, dimension, objectivity. All of these things belong to the manifestation, not to you. And so, when we say that you are ananda or anantam, limitless, without end, does that have anything to do with size? It doesn't. It has to do only with one without a second. Means the maya has the size and the dimension. The imagination has the size and the dimension. But the imagination, whether it's Ishvara's projection of this infinite creation, which has infinite size, or your little meadow, you know, which has its own size, the size, the space, the dimension comes and goes as part of the maya upadi. You are infinite in that, in terms of the satyam, what is really there as existence itself has no second. There are two existences, because for two existences you'd have to have two things that are both non-objectifiable, and then there's nothing to divide them. So there's only one existence, one being, which is satyam, and everything else depends on it for its being, including space, including dimension, including time. So that means that what makes you infinite is not that you're big or small. These words don't apply. They apply only to maya. What makes you infinite is that there's nothing but you. Say you withdraw the maya upadi. Say you withdraw the maya upadi, whether it be the maya conditioning adjunct, the whole manifest creation, or you withdraw the meadow. Then, how tall, let's say like this, how tall is consciousness? Right? How wide? Those require duality. They require the meadow. How tall? How wide? What color are you? Are you male or female? These things are absolutely meaningful, meaningless. When you're sitting in contemplation and just being with yourself, recognizing your own self-evident nature, the one that is there lighting up all of the thoughts that go by, you know, have one of those thoughts ask, what is my shape? What do I look like? What color am I? What size am I? You'll find all of these questions are meaningless. They don't apply to your being. You know? Your being is neither big nor small. It is. It doesn't have an end, nor does it have a beginning. These are not relevant. That's questions. And so when you sit, it's really interesting to sit in contemplation and ask these things, because all that shines back at you is a non-dimensional me. Just me. It's got a right side, doesn't have a left side, doesn't have a back, doesn't have a front, doesn't have an up, doesn't have a down. It is just me. Consciousness that I am. The consciousness that right now, as any jiva, recognizes as me, but takes it to be the body. You properly identify yourself as me because you are you. That's not the problem. Your sense of self is correct. It is Brahman. The agnanam is that you don't take it as Brahman, you take it as body. That's the problem. It's not that you have mislabeled yourself. That part is correct. It's just that then you've lassoed all of these other things and made it into a limited thing with name and form. Mm. Like, look at the clay pots. Look at the pots problem. Mm. You know? The pot will say, I am clay. The pot is saying, I am clay. Perfectly correct. What else is it? It's only clay. So perfectly correct. But it doesn't realize that it, the clay, which it is totally free of the pot. The clay is independent of the pot. But the pot is totally correct in saying, I am clay. So you have to be able to say, I, this body, you know, this body is Brahman. It's not anything else. It is Brahman. When you say this body is me, that me is Brahman. But so you have to be able to say, this body is me, like the pot is clay. But I am free of the body. That's the thing. That's the satyamitya. Right? This body is me, but I am free of the body. This mind is me, but I am free of my mind. The sense organs are me, but I am free of the sense organs. So this is the key thing, because if this isn't understood, then you're looking for a me. Yeah. You're looking somewhere for a me, and then what liberation is that? Because you want to be me. You know, you want me. I want to be liberated. I want to be the one who survives death. Right? And you have to recognize that, oh, I am the one that survives death. Not an I don't know. It's not an I to be discovered elsewhere. It's that I, the one that is the self of this body, that I take, I am this body. In fact, that's a good meditation. It's a very powerful meditation to just sit and say, I am this body. Who is the I that is this body? It's like the pot saying, you know, who is the clay that is this pot? You know, however, you know. Who is the I that is this body? Because then you're not trying to find something. Right? Because the I is this body. It's just the I is free of the body. You know, that's what you... But so you have to start somewhere. So find the I in the body. That's the correct I. Now find the I in the sense organs. That's the correct I. Find the I in the mind. That's the correct I. And then you just recognize that this I, which is the I of all of these things, is also free of all of these things, because all of these things are objectifiable and changing. That you are the self of all of these things, and you are free of them. But this takes a lot of words. I mean, just think of the mumuksha in the meadow. And the job of the teacher to straighten all of this out, because as human beings, we are a product of this creation. The body, the mind, sense organs, we are meant to relate to this creation. So if you have a dream, all of the characters in the dream are meant to be part and parcel of the dream. They're part of the story, you know? And so all of their means of knowledge and their organs of action and everything, they're all meant to engage in this. And then one strange one. One blessed, you know, one tremendous punya. As the serious, serious question. It's not just pretend. Or it's not just a by the way question. It's I really want to know what this is. Because this doesn't work. There's no way I can find any type of lasting security or wholeness or well-being in this creation, that, because nothing's solid here, nothing, everything's changing. So is there, you know, you say a prayer to the Lord, if there is some truth, please teach me, please save me, because you realize that with your means of knowledge and who you are, there's no way to answer that question. And so you throw your hands up and say, if there's an answer, please help me. You know? Those are prayers. Every mumuksha will make some sort of prayer like that. You know? There's some shraddha also. You know? Some shraddha in God. Some kind of... There must be something there. If you're there, please, now is the time. If you're there, now is the time. Please come and help me. That's how it is, you know. And then the Shastra will say, when that mumukshutvam is there, then Bhagavan then will come in some form. The karmas are such that you'll meet just at the right time. That's why we all have such good stories. You know, you all have a story. Every one of us has a story. You know, when you were like, they have even stories in the Shastra, you know, it's like...
Hair on fire.
How you would run into the water or drowning in the ocean, somebody picks you up and puts you on the boat and rows you to the other side, you know, drops you off on the shore, you know. Or somebody drowning, another one is somebody drowning in the ocean, you know, drowning in the ocean. And this one goes like this, they're drowning in the ocean, and the undertow will pull them down and then push them back up. And then they get pushed back up and they go, oh, I can finally breathe. Oh, this is so good. Gets pulled down, you know. Pushed back up, pulled down, pushed back up. Every time being pushed back up, they feel so happy. Thank God, thank good. Then after some time they go, this isn't good enough. I don't want to be pushed up and then pulled back down. I want to be put on the shore. I need to be put on the shore. I'm not going to look forward to getting it, you know. A breath of air just to be pulled back down. Please take me to the shore. You know, so they have all of these kind of stories. So we also, we all have our stories. You know? So here with this this teaching methodology, there's a lot in it, a lot in this, why they even started with this neti neti and then end with the last line, deva devam, you know, deva devam, because that's a positive assertion. You are the consciousness of that which is consciousness, the deva, the devam, you are ajam. Being that consciousness unborn means you're not an object within the samsara, within the manifest creation. You're achutam. You don't, for you there is no death at all. You're agriyam, you're the first cause, you're the one from whom everything has come, is sustained and resolves into. That's the vision, you know, of the Upanishad, and that's what's taught. Ahuhu means that which, that's what the wise people who know this, these Paramahamsas in the first verse, that's what they have to teach. So,
was that only one line?
Two lines. Okay, so we'll do the next verse. Let's just take a minute. We'll do it next week. Purnamidam, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamadachate, Purnasya Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.